Accession number 33250, reel 12.
Yeah. So John Wilton, reel 12. And while you were aboard, were you able to keep in contact with people back in the UK with your family?
Yes and no. You very seldom got an opportunity to sit down and write a decent letter. Occasionally you did. For example, when you went on leave, you could write a decent letter if you were out of the line and billeted somewhere where there was a table on which you could put a paper and write. You could do it. But there was also there were long periods when you could either send nothing at all, or you could send one of these stereotyped things which they would issue. You could scribble a quick, I'm all right, and so forth, and that was photographed. And reduced to the size of a sort of pinpoint and transmitted by the thousand, enlarged and delivered at the other end. So that the answer was yes, you could receive mail, and you could, generally speaking, send something wherever you were. If, as was my case, I was in hospital and so forth, no problem. While we were in Egypt, and especially while I was in Egypt in hospital, I could write a proper letter and get it into the post, and off it went. No trouble. The Army Post Office system worked. And worked very well. British Forces Post Office, the BFPO, you were given the number, your address was Major So and So, Royal Irish Fusiliers, CMF, BIFPO, BF. British Forces PO number so and so, that would get anything to you that was posted in UK or.
While you're in Italy, were you able to follow, or did you receive news of what was happening in other areas of the war, other fronts?
From time to time, yes. In Italy, in Egypt and in Italy, there was a forces newspaper, which you saw if you weren't in the line, but if you were in the line, it was unlikely that you were going to see very much of a newspaper. Similarly, if you were as I was, second in command of a company that was doing the fighting, and you were in B echelon, you could listen to the radio and you could hear the BBC news and all the rest of it. But if you were in a trench on top of Monte Cassino, you couldn't. It was always very, very patchy.
So if we go back to Austria then, what was yes. the role of your battalion in Austria?
Well, it was, as I said, to watch the frontier and generally to keep an eye on what went on, and from time to time you got a directive saying that you were to do this or you were to do that. There was a time when you had to put people on trains coming in and out of the area, the frontier zone, which was what we were occupying, and they were supposed to examine the tickets of the passengers, or the identity card. Fairly useless operation. You put a few untrained in that particular business on a train who don't speak the language and ask them to check the passenger's identity cards. It's useless. You know, there are all sorts of lovely jokes about one of the many permits that it was necessary to have was called an Ausweis. You would see a chap coming along the train and saying, "Got your Ausweis? Got your Ausweis?" No, well, that was not really a very efficient way of controlling things. But then, as time wore on, it became fairly clear that there wasn't anything much to control. If anybody had tried to start some sort of trouble, the majority of the population by that time had had enough trouble, and they would have come and said, "Look, there's a chap down there who's doing this, that, or the other." It never happened, really. After the initial days when we rounded up chaps like the director of the Hitler Youth School and so on, that was it. When you got into a town like Villach, everybody knew who had been the Nazi enthusiast and the chap who'd made a nuisance of himself and so forth. That was all dealt with locally by the Austrians themselves. The field security unit would be there in Villach, in Klagenfurt and so on, and they would hear of various cases and so on, and people would be run into the field security unit for checking, examination, and so forth. But we really didn't get involved in that sort of thing very much at all. And my dealings with the population were quite different, really. To give you an example, there was a doctor in Villach who was a very sensible and cooperative chap, and his wife was a doctor too, and the pair of them kept their practice going and so on. They were in Villach. He didn't have much in the way of petrol to allow him to tour around the country looking for people. So if something happened, as when an old lady in the village fell downstairs and broke her wrist, what do you do? Well, the answer is you put her in the jeep and you drive into Villach to the doctor and you say, "She's broken her wrist." Some chap comes along with a swollen face and says, I've got an ulcer in my teeth or some horrible thing. And the regimental medical officer would give him some aspirin, or, and I mean, what else did we do? Well, they did as much for us as we did for them. In the winter, when it snowed, they would volunteer to teach people to ski. They had in Lachak, where we were, they had a ski jump, and you could go and watch the ski jumping. It was when the lake froze, you could go and skate on the lake. The people in the hotel and the village and so forth would say, look, don't skate on the lake, it's not safe this week, but you know, or next week the lake's okay for skating and so on. It was it was a very simple sort of life, really. At the beginning of the war, at the first months that we were there, it was clear that there was going to be a great fuel shortage, and as we were living in a wooded area, we were asked if we wanted to go and do some forestry and, you know, help chop down trees and so on. And so for a while, under instruction and supervision of people who knew what was what, we did get away quite a lot of firewood, but eventually some statistician pointed out that more wood was burned by the train that took it to Vienna than the load, really. You'd burn most of the load getting it there, was his argument. They were not easy days, but slowly. A brewery opened up, you know, and people could actually buy beer. Not just the NAFI organised the brewing of beer and the issue of the sale of beer in the ration, not in the ration, in the NAFI, and so on, but the populace got beer. There was beer the day we arrived and for a couple of days after that, and then there wasn't any beer for weeks. So, but
so how long were you stationed on then?
We arrived in May, and I was demobilised until October of the following year. October 46, because I didn't get into the army till 1942, so I wasn't one of the first to be let out. So that's May till October, it's nearly 18 months.
So you returned to the UK in October 1946?
Yes.
How did you get back to the UK?
On a train. But we had leave. Mine came up in October 1945. They organised a route across Europe where you piled into trucks with benches in them and were driven for 4 or 5 days across Europe for a fortnight's leave. God, that was death on the back. And also, of course, the roads were appalling, concrete autobahns were beginning to break up or had been damaged in any case. Bridges had been blown and the truck went bouncing and bumping down at something that the engineers had managed to flatten out a bit and splosh through the bottom or over a Bailey Bridge at the bottom and climbed up out the other side. It was a fairly exhausting journey, but it was leave, you know, we were going home, and parts of it were wonderful. The first night you were up in the Alps, then you went on to Ulm and down to the Rhine and bought a couple of bottles of German champagne type wine to take home, and then across France. And one thing that I remember is that when we got to Benelux, Luxembourg. Okay, when we got to Luxembourg, we were in an American zone. And when we stopped for our 11s or whatever, there were this great marquee, and we got coffee and donuts. We hadn't seen coffee in of a sort in Egypt. Donuts, no, I mean not since before the war. But the Americans, as you know, can't exist for very long without coffee and donuts, and so any such stop as that, the staff provide coffee and donuts instead of tea and a char and a wad. So that was the... And Luxembourg is a spectacular place. It's built on a great ravine. It's quite a sight. And then, of course, the dreary bit across the flat bit of northern France to Calais or Dover, wherever you're, Calais or Boulogne, whichever one you're bound for. And home.
Did you get up to much on that leave? Did you get up to much on that leave at home? Were you able to see friends? Or
I was kept very busy because my father had died during the war and I'd not been able to get home. So it was a case of going to see my mother, who was staying with friends who said, come and stay, you're welcome, and so on. And my mother at this time was looking for somewhere to live. So I spent much of my leave looking at places and finally agreeing with her that the place that she wanted was this little bungalow. And then... going and helping to move her in. It was a fortunate idea.
Can you tell me about your leave at home?
Yes. Well, that was it. It was it was 3 weeks. You know, and it went very fast, and then we drove back again.
And then, in October 1946, you returned home for demobilisation.
Sorry?
In October 1946, you came back to the UK again. What happened to you when you arrived in the UK then?
Ah, well, now, in the last months, of my time, well, indeed the whole time that I was in Austria, I was thinking about what I might now do by way of a job, and I applied for a job in the civil service in under what was called the release period education scheme or something of the sort, as a result of which I sat and took the examination for the Foreign Office or the senior branch of the Home Service departments, whatever they was available, and I passed the first stage of that while I was in Austria. I went and sat a written examination in Austria. As I hoped that I might get into the Foreign Office, I spent as much time as I could polishing German as opposed to learning to chatter with the natives, you know, the sort of daily civilities of, and so on. I actually learnt to read and write fairly correctly and so on. So when I was released, I was having passed the first stage. I then was subjected to the second stage of selection, which is by interview and aptitude tests and all that sort of thing, which was done in a what was called a country house, where you went and stayed in a large establishment where you were with a group of a dozen others. You were put through various tests, discussions, debates, dealing with theoreticals and problems and so on, you know, that form of personnel selection which is still used, eventually I was told that I'd passed that too, so I went home on leave. I went home on demobilization in October. I decided that I would spend as long as I could survive in Paris on the £25 that one was allowed to take to convert into francs. And I stayed almost a month in France on my £25. And polished my French a bit, and so I mean that, then in January of 1947, very at the beginning of the month, I was told that I had passed the examination. The chap rang up and said, happy to tell you that you've passed in the Foreign Office. When can you start? And I said, well, I'm halfway through my degree at Oxford and I'm supposed to go back for another four or five terms to finish off. So 18 months, you know. And he said, we rather hoped you'd start on Tuesday. And I said, yes, but wouldn't you rather that that I completed my education and so forth? No, we'll teach you anything you need to know from now on. Tuesday, then. as it seemed that I had the job, which was as good as anything I was going to get if I did go back to Oxford and find out to my distress that I'd forgotten how to study. I said all right, and Friday, Tuesday then, and I then had to make grovelling excuses to the dean of my college, who was expecting that I would be turning up, and there you are.
Had you had to go to a demobilisation centre? Had to go to a demobilisation centre to be signed off on that?
Yes. And kitted out, got your demob suit and your overcoat and your pork pie hat and your shoes and as you left, they said, "And do you want a driving license?" And yes, please. And well, see the sergeant at the next. So you saw the sergeant. And you were taken out to a vehicle which was a Ford 1500 weight, not the easiest vehicle to drive, and he said, "Right, in you get, off you go." Out through the barracks, and he said, "Right, turn left here, down to a roundabout, rather a steep hill, this was all shot, down to a roundabout," came down to the roundabout, steep hill, double D clutch, down. He said, "All right, go back." And I got my driving license. The fact that I could double D clutch a Ford 1500 weight impressed him, but then I'd been doing that sort of thing for a few years, and so they were the Ford 1500 that I mentioned, of course, didn't have synchromesh gears or anything like that. You got it right, or it made a nasty noise. But if you could drive a Bren carrier, which had the same engine and gearbox, but had the drag of the tracks instead of the wheel, you had to be pretty damn quick with your gear change. Because the drag, the slowing down effect, was very much greater with the carrier than it was with a truck. So, if you could do a carrier, which I learnt to do, you would have no difficulty with the truck. Same thing when I was years later when I was. In Sharjah as the political officer, and I had a Land Rover to drive that too. Didn't have a synchromesh gearbox in those days, and if you were driving through loose sand, you had to be pretty spry with the gear lever, otherwise the drag meant that you'd if you were unlucky, you would come to a halt, and if you come to a halt in loose sand, you got a problem about starting up again, getting out again. So there it was. One thing I could do was drive difficult vehicles. Nowadays I drive an automatic gear shift.